Michael Kelly. I'm the founder of GIY.
I'm Karen O'Donoghue, and my current title, because it changes regularly, is Head of Community Development with GIY.
We kickstart Series 2 of Chew the Fat, the podcast by us, Patrick and Russell, a.k.a. Gastrogaze, in the sunny southeast of Ireland, County Waterford. Well, Waterford City, to be exact.
We're sitting down with Mick and Karen, two of the most well-known faces and voices behind the Grow It Yourself movement, which began a decade ago. The premise? Quite simply, to encourage people to grow their own food and foster a connection between what's on their plate, how it got there, and the land where it originated.
Now, within those 10 years, there's been a book, a cafe, an educational centre, thousands of members, and a popular RTE TV series, and that's only scratching the surface of what this pair and their talented, hardworking team get up to at Grow HQ.
We've long wanted to take a personal pilgrimage to Grow HQ in Waterford since we're becoming more and more interested in growing our own. Root to leaf cooking, a bit like nose to tail, but with vegetables. And we're super excited as well to let you in on the details of our own pop-up at Grow HQ in early 2019, which we'll tell you more about at the end of this episode. But in the meantime, I'm Russell Alford.
And I'm Patrick Hanlon.
And welcome to Chew the Fat.
First time that it's been planted, pumpkins, isn't it?
We've had them out in, in our other, we've another growing site out on the Cork Road. It's the first time we've had them here. And yeah, they're in the second series as one of the veg pumpkins, so that's why they're making a big appearance this year.
Because we wanted to plant different sizes, and the one that you probably drove past up there isn't. I keep wanting to say the Big Mac. It's clearly not the Big Mac. Is it the Mac Daddy?
No, Big Mac.
Okay, I'm renaming it. I'm all over the detail as per usual. So obviously we couldn't plant them down in our raised beds in our TV garden. So we asked Richard to allocate some space up by the glass house.
It's not, you know, the giant pumpkins that you kind of hear about, like that's, you can't even get your arms around them. They're so the size of a small car. It's not quite that size, but it's not far off it. So we have a nice mix of kind of, they'd be kind of for show, I suppose, and then the more edible, tasty ones as well around the place.
So what did you think when you rocked in to Grow HQ?
Oh, we were like walking around like in the days going, oh my god, look at that. It took us about 5 minutes to get from the car to here because we're just admiring like the size of the rhubarb, the pumpkins.
The pumpkins, all of the herbs. Yeah.
We love that there's a TV garden. It's very showbiz.
Very pristine. It's cordoned off.
There's a security guard, a velvet robe. It's how it should go. The reception to the TV show, though, in particular, has been fantastic. It really has been. As far as, you know, we see it online as well as on TV and in press. It has gotten a great reception. And, you know, it's part of a wider movement, a wider education. How has it been kind of transitioning from this to TV, I suppose, for you guys?
Well, I think I can't talk very much about the bigger context with GIY. I'm going to let the founder answer that question. But interestingly, it was a brilliant opportunity. One which, you know, I have to say we drove really as much as anything else. We didn't have any Hollywood agents or RTE agents come knocking on our door. I suppose it's just that over the last few years, clearly we've met loads of really great people. And so we knew who to pick up the phone and contact when it became abundantly clear through all the other work we do with our campaigns. As Grow HQ was being fundraised for and being built, that there was an increasing demand out there of people of all ages and backgrounds and abilities to really get growing. And so when we knew that, we were able to then go very confidently and with conviction. Oh, sorry, that's the microwave with the pot noodles there behind. Oh my God, I'd be shot. Our head chef, JB. No, microwave, 30 seconds. I just got the evils from the kitchen. I said microwave and pot noodles. His three favourite
beef
words.
Beef and chili, that's my favourite variety of pot noodles.
Puke. So we were able to go with conviction and make the phone call to David Hare, who is the series producer. And then all the planets were aligned because RTE were actively looking for something new. And so between that and getting two really, really strong sponsors, Bord Bia and the EPA through the Stop Food Waste campaign, sure, it was going to be gold. And, you know, they took a bit of a punt on us because not only did we need to go and champion food growing as something that was going to be both educational and entertaining? But sure, look at the state of these two heads that we were asking to give permission to present it. But we must have done something right, because you're right, guys. There was an amazing response to it. It wasn't just our respective moms hitting repeat on the iPlayer. Although, you know, there's at least 5,000 of them. But, you know, we must have done something right, because we're back again in production for Series 2. And every day, whether it's somebody rocking in here like Luke Kenny, who's about 6, who drew us a beautiful little thank you card up there, whether it's meeting people on a course that still even look a little bit starstruck, and we're like, us? Really? Who? What? Oh, yeah, right.
Superstars.
You know, or all the PR that was generated, or all the feedback we got from Bloom, it's a thing. So, yeah, long may it continue.
So is there anything, so you're halfway through 2 now. Is there anything that you've learned from the first series that you're changing or that you're adding a twist to?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think we've 7 new veg for one thing. So we always kind of wanted to cover one veg per episode, and kind of you'd see it from plot to plate. So hence we have to record it kind of right through the year. So you're seeing, like, let's say it's carrots in one episode, you see it from a seed being sown right up to growing through the year and then being eaten at the end of the year. So that's, we film a couple of days a month to capture that. And that was kind of part of the whole, I guess the ethos of what we were trying to do. That for me, the frustration was that food growing was always presented on TV as a gardening activity and, you know, the gardener's world style thing. And it was in between, you know, here's some tips for your hostas or whatever, like, which is always like, and lots of Latin names for plants and all that. So I was like, why has it never been presented as a food show before, you know? So no more so than they were taking a bit of a punt with me and Karen being so green around the gills, rough around the edges. There was also just, you know, it was the first time it's been presented as a food show with the cookery element to it as well. So that was very exciting. And the book, our book, Grow, Cook, Eat, was the same. It was a sort of a genre-splitting event, which meant it's crap sales because nobody, no bookshop knew where to put it, you know. It was like, does it go in the gardening section or the cookery section? So anyway, that was the whole point of it. And so this year we've got a brand new lineup of 7 different veg from last year. Some really kind of interesting veg in there, I think. Some really challenging ones as well, like sweet corn, which no rightfully minded person would ever try and grow.
It'll be worth it, though. It'll be worth it.
And what else have we done? Yeah, we're obviously, we had 2 amazing chefs last year with Jessica Murphy from Kai and
Jack
from Sprout. And this year, are we allowed to say who it's going to be? Or is that a bit of an announcement?
Yeah, we can. Ladies and gentlemen, the chef for Series 2 of Grow, Cook, Eat is Katie Sanderson. Woohoo!
What a superstar.
So again, I'm not going to go into details of the recipes, even though I do know. Oh yeah, I love having the secret information. But again, she fully embraces what we're doing anyway, and she's going to put a really nice kind of twist on some of the veg so that it's not just your kind of humdrum way of going about cooking things, but it still had to appeal to somebody like me, who got kicked out of home economics in 1990 something or other and doesn't consider herself. Oi now, Michael Kelly, speak for yourself. But who still wants to give something a go and for it to look lovely and impressive if I ever get around to throwing a dinner party, but for whom foodies like yourselves would still recognize as being, you know, ambitious and using great ingredients. So again, it had to be realistically ambitious, and she's just going to knock our socks off. Yeah.
I can't let that go. How did you get kicked out of home economics? You have to tell everything.
Okay. Well,
socks not pulled up.
Yes. Well, there was definitely 10 whole Doc Martens and a shaved head, because obviously I was a cure head. Totally. It was because I became a vegetarian. So I went to boarding school, right? Clochmuir down in Crosshaven, and I became vegetarian. And so for my home economic test, I had to prepare veal. And I said, no way, Jose, it's not happening. So I was clearly a bit of an old activist at the time. And Sister Michael gave me a look, and I looked her right back. And so I was asked to excuse myself from the classroom and to never return. And I was like, all right then, laters. And off I went out to the corridor.
I think that attitude still continues to this day.
Like a normal meeting for me. I'm like Sister, or whatever her name is now. Trying. Karen, will you write a proposal there for her? And she's like, all right, whatever, bye.
And then you still send me out to the corridor. Yeah. It's true.
Nothing changes.
In fact, the only thing is that I've changed my footwear. But I might embrace the docks again. You never know. Yeah.
So here we are in Grow HQ. And it's been here 2 years so far. So explain to everyone at home what Grow HQ is.
DIY is 10 years old this October. And we're very, very excited about that. And we started life as a kind of a food movement, I suppose, encouraging people to grow their own food. There's the beef. It's ready. He didn't give it long enough the first time.
He didn't add enough water.
Jesus. So anyway, we started as a voluntary community group here in Waterford and quickly took off into a national organization and a movement to promote food growing. And we'd always done our work from an office here in Waterford, various office mm-hmm. locations, one worse than the other, across the city. And you know, we were always very conscious we wanted to kind of create a place that would be the home of the movement, I suppose, and also, you know, a showcase for the lifestyle and for what we do. So it's been in kind of gestation, I suppose, for about 5 or 6 years. We approached the city council, said, look, we want DIY started here in Waterford, and we want to put down roots here and create something as the home of the movement. And they were very supportive. In fairness to them, it was the height of the recession, so I think they were open to ideas for land banks around the place. So we approached them about it. Originally, to be honest, I had in mind that we'd do something Ballymaloe-esque down a leafy lane or whatever, and they brought us to see this site that we're sitting on, which was a field at the time, and we're right in the heart of kind of, I suppose, suburban retail land in Waterford. And my original thoughts were like, this is awful. Like, nobody in the right mind to try and create something here. And it kind of just got in on our heads, I think, over the next few days and weeks, where I suppose what struck me first was the hospital. The main hospital is across the road here. So, you know, they're all about treating people when they're sick, and DIY is all about helping people to keep well through better food decisions. And the fact that we're right where people do their shopping generally, like we've Aldi and Lidl and Tesco and so on our doorstep. So we kind of felt then this is exactly where we should be doing it, right under people's noses. We've 30,000 cars a day pass by our door. So anyway, we got the land. The city gave it to us on a 100-year lease for free, which was amazing. So we started fundraising to build the place. And really, it was all about creating a place where people could come and learn how to grow and cook food. But I think primarily we felt this room that we're sitting in now would be the real kind of engine and heart of it, because, you know, people who come on a course, they've already made up their mind to make some changes in their lives, whereas the people that keep me up at night are the, you know, the ones that haven't. So this is how we reach them, hopefully. So the room is set up very deliberately as a, you know, glass on three sides, so you're looking out on where the food is grown, really open kitchen, so you're looking in, you know, to where it's cooked. So it's all about just taking down the barriers between where food is grown and cooked and eaten. So we hopefully get them in here, they experience what homegrown food tastes like, and then hopefully are nudged towards a deeper life change, or just come and have a really good latte or whatever, you know. So that's kind of the idea behind it, and it's been amazing, amazing journey. Yeah.
What I love about it, as a kind of really simple example, is when we started, you know, we all knew that we needed to sign up to the DIY message. So clearly seasonality is hugely important. And JB Dubois is our head chef. He has a great team there in the kitchen. who works very, very closely with Richard Mee. He's our head grower. And despite the jokes of microwaving highly processed, cheap crap food, which he doesn't do, he's an award-winning chef and has gotten us a huge amount of attention for the menu and the food we have here. Those two work really closely together. So literally what's available in the garden is what dictates the menu, as opposed to the menu dictating what we order from whatever supplier we need to get stuff from. And that all sounds great and really nice in concept and as a theory, but actually we put it into practice. So much so that when we're here and we have all our lovely customers, if tomatoes are gone because they're either out of season or we've used up the ketchup that we made, we serve beetroot ketchup. And even that as a change, you know, because people go, huh, what? Why can't I have tomato ketchup? And of course, between Emma and Elizabeth and Kelly and all the other Paul that we have here working front of house, they know to explain that decision to that customer. And even if it's just that conversation gets people to think, oh yeah, okay, so tomatoes actually aren't available 12 months of the year. Then we have gotten, them thinking, a job well done. So it's simple things and big things, but it's all towards the common goal of getting people to change and to grow food.
I suppose what's been interesting to watch though as we develop that model is, so like, what's different between here and most regular, you know, saner cafes and restaurants is that like we have a garden team like who obviously are paid a wage, and I suppose then we also have an approach in the kitchen which is completely different, because we're not buying in veg pre-packed or vac-packed or whatever. It's all prepped. It comes into the kitchen. It has to be, you know, washed and chopped and peeled and diced and whatever. And so, like, it's an incredibly expensive way to do things. Like, we knew it was going to be like that, but we didn't realize just to what extent.
It was an Excel spreadsheet. It was. It's a reality. Like, oh, okay.
Which was totally wrong, as it turns out. So, like, it's like most cafes and restaurants operate to fine margins anyway. Like, it's a tough business, as we all know. But ours is an incredibly expensive way to do things. And you know, we have a bit of latitude in that we're not for profit, we're a social enterprise, so our core objective is not necessarily to make money, but it has to wash its own face. And it's I suppose how we do that then is, we obviously, the garden team are about growing, but they're also about educating, and so Richard teaches in the cookery, you know, in the teaching growing courses, and JB teaches cookery classes and so on. So it's just about making the whole place work. It needs all those bits of additional income to work.
But you know what as well? Like, the fact that it does cost more, I suppose in itself, that is another message of DIY, and it's something that we're really conscious of. So, and I just know this myself, having completely changed my attitude to food as a result of joining DIY. First of all, like, as a just a grower through a DIY group, and obviously then having hounded your man for a job, now being a member of the team. But my shopping habits have changed completely, and yes, I spend more money on food, and rightly so. And not only does that mean I'm making better food choices and buying significantly better food for my children and I, but I was just thinking about this the other day, it also means I have less money to spend on crap I don't actually need. And so I'm not saying that we are spending money on stuff we have got money that we've no longer available to spend on stuff we don't need. But in a way, even the challenge that we face here on a kind of commercial or semi-macro scale is the same challenge that could be faced at home. And ultimately, that's the decision we all have to make. You know, so I found that yesterday as well. You know, we had the Cottage Market Collective here yesterday, which was amazing. There was about 16 or 18 stalls of really, really talented producers. I'm not going to tell you how much I spent on chopping boards, okay, because that's going to go with me to the grave. But
a lovely wooden pen, because who doesn't need a wooden pen?
Who doesn't need a wooden pen? And for sure, there was a kind of moment of like, but actually, it gets easier to spend money on good quality, high value products, knowing that I met Justin, who made them, and I understood his story and his commitment and his passion and his craft, and therefore I'm now not going to go and pick up plastic imported muckology from wherever, you know, because I'm just more conscious of my spending. So that in itself is a kind of additional benefit, I think, from growing your own food and appreciating it.
Yeah, like I think we really want to celebrate and try and like revalue veg as well, because it's one of the it's one of the least sort of appreciated parts of the food chain, I guess. And so like we're not vegetarian because I suppose we want it to be mass market. Like everything we do in DIY is about reaching as many people as we can. So we're not, you know, we didn't go down a vegetarian or vegan route for that reason. But we are probably, if a normal restaurant is say 70-30, you know, meat, fish and veg, we'd be the other way around probably. So we do try and put veg center stage. And it's like yesterday actually, my kids had brought in some produce from home and were selling it at the stalls here yesterday.
Now tell the truth, right? Why are they selling that produce, Michael Kelly?
Because we're trying to fund a skiing holiday later in the year. And I drive them very hard.
What's the view from the high horse up there, like, dude? Oh, yeah.
Helps.
Yeah. So anyway, selling money.
So anyway,
selling produce.
So she had a fantastic array of cucumbers and courgettes she was selling. Right now it's peak glut territory, so they're sort of in abundance at the moment. But she was selling them for I think it was €2 a pop, and some lady came up and started like giving out yards about it, saying like you get these in Lidl for whatever, and it like
to Vika.
Yeah, yes. But like you'd I suppose in general, like again the other day I went into a supermarket and we've an amazing grower at the road here, a veg grower called Tom Cleary, and he had a cabbage, like honest to God it was the size of a football, right? For and I was thinking, you could bring that home now and chop, like I'm not a big fan of cabbage, like bacon and cabbage style cabbage, but you could bring it home and cut it into quadrants and have coleslaw for the next like three weeks or sauerkraut or whatever. And it was for sale for £1.39 in the supermarket. Like, and if you think about the equivalent of, like, even pound per pound of a steak or fish or whatever, like, we have no value whatsoever on our veg growers. And I just think, like, it's really dangerous in the sense that, not to get too serious about it, but, like, we've gone from a scenario in Ireland where we had well over 600 commercial veg growers. We're down to 160 now. And because of the drought this year, we could lose half of them. And the reality for all of us then is all the only veg you can get is going to be imported, probably Dutch, tasting of almost nothing at all. Like, and so we've got to vote with our wallets and say, actually, I'm going to support local growers and you know, keep that stuff on the shelves.
As part of kind of a wider movement in food within Ireland, are you sensing in the, I suppose, 10 years since starting DIY, are you seeing people becoming more aware of buying local, buying fresh, buying seasonal, or is there still a bit of a battle going on with that?
Yeah, there is always a battle, and I think all of us can kind of empathize with that battle, even standing in the aisle in the supermarket and trying to weigh up, you know, local, yep, seasonal food miles,
organic.
Yeah, it's a tough call oftentimes. So I think, but I do think we've seen the opportunity has shifted, and our message has very much shifted away from sustainability, which I think is where we were really rooted in when we started. It was all about food miles and being self-sufficient and all of that. Whereas I think now the opportunity is around health. Like, people want to eat healthier and they see that they'll have better outcomes in their health and wellness from eating, you know, local seasonal food and growing some of it themselves. So although I think climate change is coming a bit more back on the agenda now, maybe, whereas that was just a dead space for us to operate in. You know,
someone shocked that climate change is a thing. Sorry.
I had no idea.
Climate change is a thing.
I was talking about it.
That was year round anymore.
So I think what's changed is hopefully true, and partly we've had an impact in this space is encouraging people to grow some food as a way, you know, to reconnect with their food and understand it better and appreciate it more, as opposed to a self-sufficiency thing. Because I think we kind of are. One of our original taglines actually was
you say "our," you mean mine. Your.
Yeah, this is before all the really good people joined the team. We started off, funnily enough, our actually original name wasn't GOI at all. It was the Waterford Food Producers Network.
And what was the font, Michael Kelly?
And the font was Times New Roman.
No. with when you just for like really rock and roll, some sort of leprechaun, camellia.
Yes, there was.
You know, I've seen it.
But the tagline was taking the self out of self-sufficiency.
So many great rings to everything there. I mean, I can see why everybody jumped on board instantly.
But if we wanted to be really cool, we could shorten the Waterford Food Producers Network to WFPN. So
that sounds like a sort of really small local American TV network.
Radio station.
Yeah. Hi, and welcome to WTF for y'all that.
Yeah, GIY sounds very good.
Okay, let's stick with GIY. Yeah. Decision made. Tick.
So there's a guy out the road called Queeveen Condren who, when we started the WFPN first, we were sitting around my kitchen table and he went, we're like, we need a new name. And he was like, yeah, what about, you know, like something around DIY, like do it yourself, grow it yourself, GIY. And that was it. That was like, everyone was like, yeah.
I love those quick meetings where it's just, that's a really good idea. Done. Yeah. Thank you.
How has home growing changed over the 10 years?
How has home growing changed? I think...
more containers, recognizing that it's easier to do it in
exactly,
small spaces.
Exactly, yeah. In tandem with that, with that shift away from it being hardcore kind of self-sufficiency, you know, when we started, we were talking about people like John Seymour and, you know, the complete guide to self-sufficiency and the good life and all that, and keeping your own hens and pigs and the whole, you know, the whole almost bunker mentality of the world is absolutely screwed and, you know, we need to grow everything ourselves and rear our own animals and all that into, which let's be honest, has a very niche appeal for most people, into something that's far more accessible and about growing wherever you call home, whether that's, you know, apartment balcony or 10-acre small holding. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, again, I can only speak in about the last couple of years, three and a bit, whereby for me it's becoming more about a lifestyle, you know, again, so it's less niche. You know, you're talking earlier about like, would our book be in cooking or gardening? And I'd love to see it in health or lifestyle area. But also, I think, just as a kind of reference back to the program and the people we've met through it, like the children that we have met through Bloom and other events that we've done, who are natural growers, okay, and who now, whether it's through topics in school about climate change or biodiversity or whatever it is, whether it's through GIY and our campaigns that we run, whether it's through the TV program, that they're realizing that what they do actually is as amazing as the kids that are brilliant at sport or maths or singing or whatever. And so it's becoming the norm again. You know, it kind of completely fell off everybody's priorities. And now it's coming back on it, but not in a kind of, as you say, oh my God, we're all going to die mode. But actually, this is a good thing to do. This is a life skill, actually.
And we survived the recession as well, which is the other thing. It was very much rooted in, like, if you think about where the country was at in 2008, it was a real, like, Jesus, the whole fabric of society is collapsing around our ears. Like, the banks were failing. Everything was going belly up. And we came right at the, I mean, we started probably, I think it was 2009 was the crash, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, like, we started at the tail end of the boom. And you know, the first 4 or 5 years we were around, it was very much, you know, Jesus, everybody's kind of trying to grab onto something that's real and all of that when everything else is shifting. So, but obviously the boom is back and getting boomier, as Bertie would say. And so we're all like GIY as an organization and as a thing that people should do has survived that transition from, you know, maybe something we need to do to something we really want to do. And that's ultimately a more stable place for us to be, I think.
When you mention about Bloom in particular, I think that's always, it's a great way to, I suppose, see the work that you're doing on a large scale because you're getting people from all over the country coming along. And I adored the fact that when you're like, okay, any questions? There's people like us just sitting there going, that was really interesting, that was really entertaining, glad we went to that. And there's a 5-year-old I'm having trouble with my courgettes. Help me. And
I'm like holding course. Yeah. Like, oh no, I've tried that already.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, they're fantastic. And even I remember going back to the first episode of our podcast, and you were amazed that Drummond House in County Louth were sending garlic to your old school.
I grew cress, and that was all I ever grew in school. And now, in my old school, they are planting garlic and they're growing it and harvesting it and learning everything about it. And it really is the children who you see have a newfound, like, where has this been?
Yeah. Oh, they just soak it up. Like, what I love about it, we do an awful lot of work with schools. So we either have The Big Grow, which is a campaign we run with Innocent, which does exactly that, Cress being one of them, gives kids in a classroom the opportunity to grow from effectively a compostable coffee cup. Brilliant. For some it's their first experience, for others who are well into it they just love sharing their knowledge within their classes. We have Grow to CEO with Cully and Sully, so that's in secondary schools and it's all about food entrepreneurship. So again, they do some growing, but it's also predominantly around what they would do with that vegetable and turning it into a soup, obviously, and a kind of Dragon's Den style presentation. And they just love it. So not only do the teachers love the fact that we're introducing food into the school, supported by curriculum-led resources, because we don't want to cause extra work for already very overworked teachers, but they love it because obviously school isn't currently formally on the curriculum. So this is a really good way of still bringing it in, but still hitting those kind of important maths, English, science, history, whatever, activities. So the children love the opportunity. Then we work with Ballymaloe Cookery School, actually, with 9 schools down in Cork, whereby we help the schools with some funding and kit resources to create a school garden that's going to meet the school year, because obviously they're all on their holidays over the summer, so it needs to be something that works in the school term. And like the demand and the want and the need and the engagement and the way the schools feed back to us with photos and videos and loads of stuff on social, like they just absolutely love it. And I would go so far as to say it's, you know, children have an innocence about it and they just want to get stuck in. They love being outdoors. They love getting their hands dirty. Don't have the hang-ups or the fear factor. I don't know how, I don't have time, and la 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 la. And once you awaken it in them, it's already there. It just needs to be facilitated and encouraged, and they just drive it forward. It's amazing.
Just to put, like, not to always take it back to boring macro level stuff, but like, unfortunately, organisations like ourselves kind of have to almost step in with these, you know, amazing campaigns, but ultimately they're point in time interventions that are instead of sustained ongoing food education, which should be just the norm in our food in our education system, and it's not. And the one thing that keeps us alive and gives us such joy in life, you know, is nearly conspicuous by its absence. Like, we've maths and English and all these things which are great, but if the shit hits the fan, excuse my French, like, they're, you know, the one subject that could really bloody help us is nowhere to be found. So like, we've a lot of work to do, I think, still, not just us, but fellow organisations, to convince government and the powers that be that's needed. You know, because on the one hand, they're battling childhood obesity and all these terrible problems in health and kids. And the other hand, they're just not joining up the dots and saying, well, actually, if we teach kids how to grow food and cook food and value food and, you know, eat healthily, we could fix that problem as well. But they're not doing it.
And there's no reason to say why you can't instill a love and a passion for things, you know, like maths or science or whatever, complemented by that real appreciation of food. And then you're preparing a whole heap of really informed, passionate, engaged people, like the next generation of our food scientists or our food economists. You know, we are an island with a reputation for really good food. We import unnecessarily too much of it because we export so much of our really good high quality produce. But again, if we're looking at the next generation of people, who not only do we need them to be alive and healthy and well physically and mentally to be taxi drivers and, you know, be all the people and the skills and the jobs that we rely on, but also to be the people who are going to drive Ireland's, you know, food policy and other forward. So it doesn't have to be an instead of. It's absolutely really complementary as well as. We just have to change our thinking. It's a little bit about going back to basics, but with all the knowledge that we have over the last few decades.
I mean, I grew up in Drogheda, Ireland's largest town, Clang.
Wannabe city.
One day city. Would be city. And in school, I chose to do agricultural science as an extra subject. And me as the townie, you know, it was a world that I had no connection to or no kind of awareness of at all, of tractors and farms and plants and growing. And to me, it was so eye-opening. And I was like, why is this not optional or like in every school? Because it was a thing that really, really helped me to engage and to connect with the ground and our heritage and our growing and Ireland's history, really. But in saying that, it was so old-fashioned and it was about identifying plants in Latin and, you know, how to impregnate a ewe and, like, you know, like, to a person who will never probably work in agriculture in that way, it was so specific. And then in terms of just general growing, it was so vague. So I think there's a real opportunity there in education of agricultural science, home ec, food, to offer a real hands-on approach that I had an inkling of, but it just is not there yet.
Yeah, and as well as that, you know, we need to be mindful that different people within our society will have different priorities, okay? Just even talk about disposable income. And so a lot of the time, certain programs or say the opportunities to shop at a farmer's market or to come on a course here or at any other great, you know, cookery school or growing school will be limited to people with a disposable income. And a lot of the time you can be talking to the worried well, okay? Whereas we need to engage people who don't know how to make changes, who may want to make the changes around food for their own health of their family or whether it's environmental or whatever, but who don't know how to do it. And so by not putting it in schools, which basically means you're denying a whole heap of children the opportunity to learn about something that is so incredibly important, that means that you're basically saying to a big chunk of the next generation, no, sorry, you're starting off on the back foot because you're not going to have the information or the inspiration that you need to make really, really good food choices. And in fact, we're still going to rely on your parents or your caregivers who equally may not have had that information and knowledge. So we're only perpetuating the problem, and we're going to keep all this information and happiness and joy and something that's really exclusive to people over here who can afford it one way or the other. So we have to remove those barriers to putting good food in front of good children, you know, and making that connection and just making it available to all of them.
We have a program that we run out of Grow HQ actually called Eat Together, which was we developed with a local school out in Tramore, an Educate Together primary school, which was basically, I suppose, a reaction to what we were seeing, and I think most parents listening to this could empathise with it, that of lunches coming back home uneaten, and the kids saying, well, look, you know, we've 10 minutes to eat our lunch and then we're shunted out into the yard or whatever. And so we took a bit of inspiration from, I suppose, the French approach to eating in schools, and we created this programme. So we deliver a two-course hot meal from here as part of an six or eight week program. And the kids sit down together, so they reconfigure the classroom to be a kind of a long table, and they sit down and eat together, like the proper, you know, they have knives and forks and cut and plates and the whole lot. And we go out and we talk about where the food came from and what's in it and so on. And just like, again, the from a very simple kind of a program, the feedback from parents and teachers was just unreal, because they said, like, the parents said, well, actually my child, who's a really picky eater, was willing to try things because he's sitting beside his buddy who's eating it. You know, they were more curious about food when they came home. They were eating stuff that, you know, children you couldn't imagine could eat. And, you know, just an amazing thing. But I suppose we're kind of confined to doing that here in Waterford, because it's only as far as the hot box can keep the food warm for. But at the same time, the department of education are spending whatever it is. I think, is it 140 million on the DESH lunch program? So they're sending free lunches into schools, which is very important. But unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it's food that's really unhealthy, highly processed. And even though they're providing food, which, let's be honest, for a child that needs a lunch, that's absolutely invaluable. But we're not thinking about how we eat and giving kids the time and the space to eat in a kind of a, you know, the way we should eat in a, I suppose, convivial atmosphere, sitting down and giving it the right amount of time and learning about the food and all of that, you know.
I suppose it's kind of a circle square kind of thing, that, you know, there's so many dots that needing to be joined in order to teach children about food, where it comes from, and that, it, you know, it starts off from the soil and ends up on your plate, and sometimes it ends up on the plate in your school, and it's just not there. And it's a real, real shame that it's only if you choose to learn a bit more, unless there's programs like your own going in.
Yeah, but then, you know, you have a program in schools at the moment which is fantastic in that it connects children with fruit and vegetables and gets them to try different foods and taste them, to encourage them to eat more fruit and vegetables. But, you know, my own two, Dylan and Saoirse, are both in primary school, and they will come home to me having been given, say, apples, okay? So to try an apple, but it's an apple that has been chopped up and put in plastic. So it's highly unlikely it's an Irish apple. I don't know, so I can't be sure. But again, there you go. Okay, I was trying to be slightly diplomatic, but, you know. Okay, so, like, that is a farce. So on the one hand, you have a huge programme and awareness piece around supporting Irish producers, talking about seasonality, talking about air miles, et cetera, et cetera. Then on the other hand, you have, but we want you to eat fruit, but actually it's okay that this one is imported and cut up and put into plastic. But by the way, try and reduce your plastic and go home and tell your parents to not make plastic packaging. Like, Jesus, no wonder the child is sitting there going like,
it is. You're absolutely right. Like, it is important to say the program you talk about is very successful and does what it's supposed to do very successfully, in that it encourages kids to try fruit and veg. And proven to do that. But you're absolutely right. There's no joined up thinking beyond that in terms of all the other programs that it should be tying into and isn't. You know?
Yeah. So, like, again, there's an awful lot of really good ideas and intentions, and a lot of it is evidence based, which it must be. But I think we need to stop thinking that nobody thinks that there's one fix to this serious, serious issue around, for example, childhood obesity. If you just look at that, it's a multifaceted, very tricky subject. But we have to stop being blinkered and thinking that, oh, well, I'm just going to target this piece and not engage all the other bodies and all the other interventions that are out there, because everybody can learn from each other. And if we do that joined up approach, together we will be greater than the sum of our parts. Come on! Do you know what I mean? I feel like I gotta stand up and get the microphone. Oh my God, there's a halo has just appeared above my head. I can't cope. But you know what I mean? Like, it sounds so obvious, and yet we're not doing it. And it requires a change in attitude and a bit of a change in policy. And it means a bit of bureaucracy would have to be put down lower the to-do list, and we just crack on together.
Can I tell my beetroot pea story?
Oh,
you remember this? You don't remember this?
I don't know.
Oh, you do, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do.
As part of Eat Together.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the weeks I went out with the hot box delivering school out to school out in Faithleg, just out the road, and the chef, like, he does either a starter and a main course or a main course and a dessert. So this week, particular week, he had a beetroot salad as the starter, and it was just literally beetroot, like, baked and cut into chunks and a bit of vinegar and oil. And I'm like, this is going to be a tough sell. So I'm standing up in front of the glass and I'm like, how am I going to get them to eat this? Like, I could see when you take it out, there's either a groan or a hooray, you know. And there was a groan when we took this out. So they're all like, beetroot. So I started telling them about the fact that when you eat beetroot, if it makes your pee go red the following day.
I knew where this
was going. Yeah.
When in doubt, introduce pee and poo to a conversation. It's fine.
It's called beeturea. It's basically, depending on how healthy your digestive tract is, that your body can break down the pigment or not. So if you have the pee, the red pee, it's a good sign, actually. It means your digestive tract is working the way it should. So I was telling the kids all about this, and I was like, if you don't try the beetroot, you can't take part in the big in the great
the big
beetroot
challenge.
Experiment. And they were all like forcing it into them, you know.
It's all marketing.
Yeah. By any means. By any means. Yeah.
They give you an update the next week.
I didn't want to know, really.
Can we have more beetroot? Big eyes up wide open.
As long as they eat it, I don't care.
So I guess children are the future, as they say, but the future for you guys. So for Grow It yourself, how are you planning the next 10 years?
Wow. It's such a big question for us. Yeah. So, I mean, we're first of all, we're all about sort of scale and reaching as many people as we can. And I think we have a sense that to use that awful phrase, to move the dial on the problem, we've got to actually go bigger and bigger. We reached about 500,000 people this year through one of our programs, which is amazing. All around the UK and Ireland. And so we've been kind of looking at the next 10 years and going, what's, you know, if we're able to reach 500,000 now, what's a good 10-year goal? And we're toying around with the number of 100 million DIYers, which would mean going way beyond the UK and Ireland and into North America. And
I have my passport ready, though. It's good. I'm ready to go.
Well, I'm doing the New York launch.
No,
we agreed that.
No, I got New York. You can do LA.
So, okay, fair enough. Hang out with Donald skiing over there.
Hang out with Donald, yeah.
So it's all about scale and reaching as many people as possible. And then we have a big question about GrowHQ and whether we want to do another one of these somewhere else. And obviously the TV show's going to Netflix.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be a movie.
Karen's going to do Dancing with the Stars next year.
Yeah!
Please,
world, if anybody out there, please let me do it. Not this year because I ruptured my Achilles tendon in April, but I will be totally fine for 2019.
Right,
I'm available. Cha-cha-cha. Yeah, I can rumba, foxtrot, whatever.
Three objectives, aren't they?
Big scaling thing,
and then you doing Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
If we do those three things, we're happy.
We're really happy. And that may sound a little ambitious, but when you think that GIY started technically in a supermarket picking up a clove of Chinese garlic, and here we are sitting in an award-winning, amazing cafe on a three-acre site that has 1,000 people through the door each week changing their hearts and minds around food, then that doesn't sound so bonkers. Plus the fact we have amazing partners who fully engage with us in terms of who we are and what we do and how they can help us achieve it, and vice versa. And, you know, the Ireland Funds is one of our supporters of an amazing philanthropic network. I always worry that I'm going to be able to say that word, but I managed it. Philanthropic. No, Michael Kelly, don't be mean.
Without a spell checker.
No, I cannot. So a philanthropic network with a huge amount of donors based in the States. So clearly they can make some fantastic introductions and referrals of us and to us. The partners that we have, a lot of them, or some of them rather, already work in other countries, so there's the potential to do it there, because we know we can't do this by ourselves, and we don't want to do this by ourselves, because otherwise what we're effectively saying is, we're right, you're wrong, because I can't stand them. But we're right, you're wrong, we know better than everybody, and that just becomes very exclusive. Whereas actually, we are well able to say we learn from every single partner that we work with. We learn from whether it's the kids asking the questions at Bloom to the people asking questions on our course. You know,
it's kind of a slight tangent, but it's been a huge part of our first 10 years and has been since, I'd say, year one or one and a half, maybe, where we always partnered with bigger brands to help us get stuff done. And that was a kind of a, I suppose, traditionally the environmental groups, which we would have been maybe called originally, would sort of frown on that kind of, you know, big brand alignment and all that. Whereas I came from a corporate background, so I was always like, big brands, they give us reach, they give us funding, they help us get our message out at scale. And if we work with people who we like and trust, and we can look ourselves in the mirror and say, these are amazing people that we work with, then happy days, you know. And the likes of Innocent, who just the scale that they allow us to operate at in schools, like we worked with, I think, 6,000 schools this year. Like it's brilliant, you know. It's such a great fit for us. It's not for everybody, but for us, it's an amazing approach.
And before we leave, hopefully everybody is enthused to grow their own now. But if you were to give those at home, what are the three easiest things to grow for the amateur home grower?
I'm going to say garlic is one, because it's timely. This time of the year, you can sow it anytime up to Christmas. Very easy to grow. One clove equals one bulb in 6 months. Great to grow. It's how I started, so I have a bit of an outgrow for it. I love beetroot, just because it's a kind of a three-in-one veg. You can eat the root, obviously, the stems and the leaves. Very easy to grow. Like, I find it almost 100% reliable. And you can be self-sufficient all year round from maybe three sowings in the year. Very, very good value for space if you don't have much space. And probably salad leaves is the third one.
Oh, I thought you were going to pick them. Potatoes.
Yeah, potatoes are a bit blighty, you know, that whole blight thing.
We never talk about that in this country. No.
They're a bit like...
ignoring our history.
Yeah. No, I'm going to say probably salad leaves as a sort of a...
for ease, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And taste.
And I suppose then on the flip side, the more difficult ones, the ones that probably someone who's really inspired should, but as a complete amateur, should probably avoid until maybe year two or three.
Oh my God. So sweet corn, asparagus.
Oh my God. Sweet corn is in series two as one of the veg, and it's an absolute nightmare. Like, it's just very hard to grow well, because it's a kind of a South American crop, needs lots of sun and heat. And even though we had all of that this year.
What? Yeah, as is a spud. Oh, we got you there.
Yeah, good point. No coming back from that. Fair enough.
One veg patch and he's, exactly. Schooling you.
Sweet corn is a nightmare, but brilliant if it comes off, but it doesn't come off much. Like, the other, I'd steer clear of the entire brassica family except kale, because such problems with pests, with cabbages, cauliflowers, all of that stuff. Just everything loves to eat it. So I nearly avoid all that, although I love kale, so I stick with kale. I think that'd be the...
Yeah.
Anything else that's...
I'll go with his, you know, him being the expert grower and all that.
Tomatoes are a nightmare as well, but they're just worth it. Yeah. So I wouldn't cross them all off your list because they're so amazing. But they're very, you're dealing with them for nearly 11 months, and they're very, you know, a lot high maintenance. They're like the Barbara Streisand of the veg world.
The really good thing about the top three that you said were easy to grow is, of course, they're all container friendly as well, so you don't need loads of space. Do not be throwing your eyes to heaven now, Michael Cauliflower. The old container. Well, listen, we don't all have 3 acres donated by the council on which to, you know, grow at will. But yeah, that is a thing. So all of those, the garlic and the salads.
Everything
and the
container growing.
Apart from sweet corn. Sweet corn is just whatever.
We're so embarrassed by our sweet corn. It's going to be on national television next. And it's like, at sweet corn. It's amazing. It's so fruit. And then it's like a total disaster.
It's good to show failures as well as successes. That's a really good thing.
You learn more from a failure than a success.
Exactly. Right? You'll help someone put that pack of sweet corn seeds down in the supermarket or in the garden centre. Yeah.
And straight into the freezer section.
Fantastic.
It is just to say, like, when it works, you will never taste anything like homegrown sweet corn, because, like, you should be running from the veg patch to the kitchen to start cooking it, because all the sugars inside are starting to turn to starch within minutes of picking it. Like, so it's an amazing, the vac packs of sweet corn in the supermarket just cannot compete.
If the last 50 minutes has not sown seeds in your mind, we don't quite know what will inspire you to get out there, get your hands in the soil and start growing your own.
As we mentioned earlier on, we've been bitten by this DIY bug over the past year since we moved back to Ireland, and we're obsessed with growing, caring for and eating from our little vegetable patch back at home. Before that, we basically killed every single potted plant and herb that we ever owned, so this really is progress for us.
It's one of the most rewarding things you can do for yourself, and there's no greater joy, honestly, no greater joy than cooking, enjoying and sharing the fruit of your labours with your family and friends. As we mentioned earlier on, we're also so very excited to tell you that we are part of a wonderful series of celebratory dinners at Grow HQ in Waterford.
Their homegrown series will see us two take over the kitchens of the cafe for a very special one-off dinner in late January 2019. If you fancy coming along, we'll be sharing the details very soon on our own social media, at GastroGaze on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, and of course on the GIY.ie website. If you've enjoyed this episode of Chew the Fat, please be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Google Play Music, or even write a review to spread the word further.
Thanks for listening.